You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Professor of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Sciences at Brown University, Stephen Sloman. He's the editor-in-chief of the journal Cognition, and his recent book is The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. In this book, he and his co-author Philip Fernbach argue that intelligence and knowledge are fundamentally communal in nature, and despite how well we might be individually educated, none of us is quite as smart as we think we are. Professor Sloman, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart. Pleasure to be here.
It's my pleasure to have you. So as I implied in the introduction, you claim that we often think we're smarter than we are, and that gap can actually be demonstrated. Would you please start with some of the research and the examples from the book that show that we live under a knowledge illusion?
Sure. So what we actually show is that people think they understand how things work better than they do. It's not quite the same as thinking they're smarter than they are. The original research was done by a great psychologist at Yale named Frank Kyle, who asked people to consider simple everyday objects like ballpoint pens, zippers, toilets. And he said he asked people to rate how well they understood how these things worked. And people would give a rating, and these are everyday objects that they use every day, and so they figured that they understood pretty well how they worked. And then Frank said to them, okay, now explain how they work. Explain in as much detail as you can exactly what the mechanism by which this thing operates is. And what he found was that people were almost entirely unable to explain the mechanisms. So that when he then again asked them to rate their understanding, their judgments were lower. So basically, people were admitting themselves that they had been living in an illusion, that they had thought they understood how these things worked, but they didn't really.
So with the zipper example, you know, the explanation might be, well, you just kind of slide the thing together and pull it up, right? But that doesn't really...
Well, right. So that people could offer that kind of very superficial explanation, but that's more about how you use it, right? It's not about how it works. So it seems like the fact that we're able to use things successfully somehow leads us to believe that we understand how they work.
Why don't we give another couple of examples, or at least, you know, one or maybe two more examples of that kind of thing where we know how to use things, but we really don't understand the operation of it. We really can't give a detailed explanation of how it actually operates.
Okay. I mean, my sense actually is if you take any object of sufficient complexity, and it doesn't have to really be very complex, you can find this effect. Another great example is with bicycles. So a woman named Rebecca Lawson at the University of Liverpool has asked people to essentially draw a bicycle. She gives them a skeleton, asks them where the pedals go and where the chain goes. And it's shocking how difficult people find this task. Your listeners might want to try it themselves. It's really much more difficult than you imagine. It turns out that even expert bike riders, members of a weekly cycling club, had trouble performing this task. And I think the reason that this example works so well is because the mechanism is visible. We can see it. And so because it's visible, because we have this strong mental image, we think we understand. But when you really have to spell out the steps, the causal steps, which makes this thing work, we find it much more difficult than we expect to. So that's one type of example. Now, my colleagues and I have also shown that you get the same effect in the political domain. So if you take a political policy, to take a random example, let's say Obamacare, and you ask people to rate how well they understand it, and then explain how it works, what that does is it bursts people's illusion of understanding so that when you ask them again after their attempt to explain how well they understand, ratings tend to be lower. And not only that, not only does this attempt to explain how something works give people an insight that their sense of their own understanding is much greater than they think it is, but in the political case, it also turns out to make them a little more humble. So if you ask them how strongly they feel pro or anti Obamacare before the attempt to explain, they give a more extreme rating than after the attempt to explain, as if their appreciation that they don't understand as well as they think they did leads them to have a little less hubris, a little more humility about how strongly they should feel regarding the policy.
Now, you argue in the book that the aim is not here that everybody should all of a sudden try to fully understand all of these things like zippers and cell phones and everything. That's really impossible. So would you talk about that a little bit, that we really can't know everything. It's too much, and maybe a little bit if you could get into what you think might be how we make those discernments about what to explore in depth and what not.
Sure. So, you know, the world is incredibly complex. Like, if you take a simple thing, like you chose zipper, there's just so much that goes into it. So the mechanism itself is quite clever, and it took society millennia to figure it out. But it's not just the mechanism that makes it complicated, right? It's also that you have to fully understand zippers would mean that you understand the metals that they're made from, or some are made from plastics, and you could try to understand metals and plastics fully, or you could try to understand how zippers are attached to clothing or the other things that they're used for. You could try to understand the economics of zippers. You could try to understand the relation between zippers and buttons and why one's more aesthetically pleasing than... I mean, I could go on and on even about this very simple thing. If you take even more complex things like biological things or you know, other aspects of the world, like the climate and how it changes, the degree of complexity is mind-boggling. And to fully understand any of these things, well, I think is impossible. To understand one aspect of them generally requires a career of focused study. So we think that the reason people have this illusion of understanding is that they fail to distinguish the knowledge that's in their heads from the knowledge that's in other people's heads. That is, other people understand how zippers work. Like, for instance, zipper manufacturers understand how zippers work. And so their understanding is kind of contagious. We get our sense of understanding because there are people around us who understand. We call this the community of knowledge. So the idea is that whenever we're thinking essentially about anything, we're actually depending on the thoughts and the understanding of other people. And you can see this whenever you're engaged in any kind of group activity. So, you know, when teams of doctors are working together, say performing surgery, or doctors and nurses and other technicians are performing surgery, everybody has their skill or their set of skills that they bring to bear. And there are certain things the surgeon is really good at, but there are other things that you would want the nurse to do. The nurse knows much better than the surgeon, you know, I don't know, how to provide the right amount of drug or something that's requested. And it seems to us that whenever people are operating, we have this kind of dependence. Philosophers call it epistemic dependence, a sort of knowledge-based dependence on what other people know. When I ride my bike, I depend on the fact that other people are capable of designing and manufacturing bikes. I also depend on the rationality of other users of the road, right? So my thought that I'm going to go left depends to some degree on my belief that the person stopped at the red light is not going to just come forging ahead and hit me. So there's a kind of dependent, cognitive dependence we have on one another, whatever we're doing. And we call this the community of knowledge. So the idea is that the mind is really a communal entity. It's not something that sits inside the skull, but it's something that sits within a society.
Yeah, I'd like... Go ahead.
No, please.
I'd like to expand on that a little bit more and get into it, I think, as a central feature of your book. And one of the points maybe we could make, too, is that it seems like two things I'll say. One is just the complexity of life these days really demands that kind of thing. And maybe in some time in the past, people could be more expert in a wider range of things than now is the case. And then also, if you would talk about how maybe the internet and the kind of access and easy access to information seems to expand on this this illusion that since we have such easy access to information, then we must know it.
Okay. So those are two very different questions.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more that the complexity of life these days makes these facts much more relevant than they were in the past. But I do want to make sure that I make clear that I believe this is a very natural property of mind. I believe that human beings evolved to live in a community of knowledge. I don't think this is a new phenomenon at all. I think that hunters and gatherers also depended on one another. There was always a division of cognitive labor, such that different people had different areas of expertise, and people lived together partly in order to make use of each other's expertise. So I don't think this is a new phenomenon, but I agree completely it's attained a level of importance today because of the degree of specialization in the world, because of the degree of complexity that we're confronted with all the time, that makes it quite profound. And I think has led to some problems and certainly has led to some great misunderstandings. So one of the problems I'll just mention briefly is, you know, I think that disparities in wealth today, which I consider a serious issue in Western society and other societies, is partly a result of the fact that we give individuals more credit than they deserve, right? So Steve Jobs founded Apple, and he's a brilliant guy, and, you know, he maybe in some sense he was the best entrepreneur ever. I don't know. I don't know how to measure that. He may have been singular in some ways, but he didn't do it alone, right? His success depended on the fact that the computer had been invented by other people. It depended on the mathematicians that made it possible to invent the computer. It was made possible by his mother and by the kids he grew up with who inspired him and the TV shows. Everything he experienced was part of the process that led to his achievements. And even his specific achievements were supported by the people who drove him around and the people who cooked his food and the people who cleaned his house. So we have a tendency to lionize individuals when, in fact, their accomplishments are the product of a whole community. And so instead of giving credit entirely to these individuals, I believe it should be spread around a little bit, precisely because we should give credit where credit is due. So that was your first question. Your
right.
Second question had to do with the internet and whether that has changed the nature of the community of knowledge and how we think. And the answer is clearly it has in many ways. Adrian Ward and Matt Fisher are a couple of psychologists who have shown that when people have access to the internet, they feel smarter. So simply the giving people the opportunity to search around to answer some questions on the internet will make them feel like they're more able to answer other completely separate questions because they feel like they have access to information. The internet is clearly part of our community of knowledge, although I wouldn't put it on the same footing as other human beings because it lacks certain basic abilities that you need to be a sort of fully fledged member of the community of knowledge. So the internet is like other human beings in that the knowledge it contains or the information it contains is contagious in the sense of understanding that it gives us. So I did a study with a student at Brown named Nat Rabb in which we showed that simply telling people that other people, experts, understood how something worked made people feel like they themselves understood how that thing worked, or at least gave them a little bump in their sense of understanding how well something worked, right? So if I tell you that experts have studied a particular policy that's being proposed by Congress, merely the fact that they have studied and think they understand what the implications of that policy are, you're going to feel like you understand what the implications of that policy are, even if I don't tell you anything about the implications, right? The sense of understanding is contagious, and it's contagious when other people understand. It's also contagious when you have access to information on the network, on the internet. So I think one implication of this is that the way we should think about knowledge is not as information that gets represented in the brain necessarily. Obviously, we have some information represented in the brain. But we should think about most of our knowledge as a set of access points. What we know isn't stuff directly. What we know often is how to find out, right? Where to go, where to look in order to find what we need. So we might look in the internet, or we might look in a reference book, or we might just look at the world around us. So, you know, if your listeners don't look up, but try to describe what their ceiling looks like without looking at it, they may be surprised by how hard a task that is. So the reason it's so hard is because usually we can just look up. The information is there in the ceiling about what the ceiling looks like. And so the world carries a lot of information for us in that sense.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is cognitive scientist Steve Sloman, co-author of The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. So let's expand on this, because I think a key issue here is the susceptibility to this illusion. Yes, we can look up and we can look things up on the internet, but isn't some of that, I don't know if thwarted is the right word, but there are some problems. There's some implications for living under this illusion for how we live in the world, right?
Oh, there are plenty. And it sounds like you have something in mind. I mean,
Not particularly.
Yeah. Okay. So, the one that you know is sort of on the front page every day these days is what the implications are for our political life. And I think one implication is that sometimes our political ideologies are based more on the fact that we believe everybody around us understands rather than direct knowledge about things. So if knowledge is contagious, right? If I think I understand how Obamacare works because the people around me all think they understand how Obamacare works, and if they think they understand how Obamacare works because the people around them think that they understand how Obamacare works, then you can have everybody having a strong sense of understanding without anybody actually understanding.
Right.
Right. You have a house of cards, essentially. And unfortunately, in the case of Obamacare, there clearly are some experts who know a lot about the details. But, you know, Obamacare is a 20,000-page document. I mean, the Affordable Care Act is over 20,000-page document. Nobody's memorized those 20,000 pages. Nobody fully understands it. Right? Medical care is unbelievably complex. There's a division of cognitive labor such that different people are experts in different areas. And yet, we all sort of have this sense that we know what it's about because we know a couple of principles, right? But we don't know the details. And so what's, you know, I think very sad today is on an issue like health care, when we talk about it as a society, we're not talking about those details. We're not talking about how to actually solve the problem. We're not locating, you know, where the real problems are in this complex mass of issues and trying to figure out how to solve them. Instead, we're just talking about basic values and, you know, one-liners to capture attention. And I actually, you know, I don't think it's a constructive way to run a society.
So the challenge, it seems to me, then, is, I mean, it's almost like you're suggesting or arguing for that we need kind of a real shift in our own awareness of our own illusion of knowledge. And certainly, it seems to me, you're arguing that a portion of that is to recognize this communal nature of knowledge and kind of how we, each of us, tend to deal with complexity by simplifying it and just taking it like we know it. How do you propose that kind of self-awareness, both individually and I guess culturally, how is that going to happen?
Well, that's the million-dollar right. question, isn't it?
Yep.
And, yeah, I wish I had a better answer for you, Stuart. I do think I have a couple of things I can say, but I certainly don't have a silver bullet to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So, first of all, it's important to notice that this is not always a problem, right? Like, the fact that I think I understand how my bike works better than I do actually has some benefits, right? It may encourage me to go for a long bike ride believing I can fix it if it breaks down. Or it may encourage, you know, my unwarranted belief that I can build a porch in my backyard might encourage me to actually go out and build a porch. And it'll take longer than I expect, and I'll have to consult more than I think. But perhaps I'll succeed. So there's a sense in which the knowledge illusion does have some positive benefits. It encourages us to do things we might not otherwise do. It also, you know, it can make us more interesting in conversation, right? Just because we're willing to engage about things, because we're confident we have something to say. It can also make us more boring when we're talking about something we don't know anything about. So it's not always a problem. It's a problem under certain circumstances when we come to beliefs and those beliefs affect other people or even affect ourselves, and those beliefs are unwarranted, right? That's when it's really a problem. So what can we do about it? Well, one thing is suggested by the first experiment we talked about, try to explain, right? So not everybody suffers from the knowledge illusion. The people who suffer from it tend to be people who are not very reflective. That is, people who say the first thing that comes to mind, who don't check themselves, who don't think before they speak. People who do will essentially try to explain to themselves before they speak. And if they discover that they can't, then they might not articulate a belief that they can't support. And, you know, the false information won't get spread around the community. So that's one piece of advice, right? Think before you speak. And another way to say it is try to explain things to yourself to gauge your level of understanding. And if we all did that, then not only would there be less hubris, more humility in our conversations, and I think we'd be more open to what other people have to say, but we'd also be talking about stuff that we can do something about, because we'd be talking about how the thing we're talking about actually works. And it's only when you understand how something actually works that you can do something about it. Right? I mean, the alternative is to talk about your values or what you like or dislike. Politicians love to talk about values. You ask them about health care, and they answer in terms of universal health coverage or government interference in human affairs, right? Because they don't have to actually deal with the complexity of the problem when instead they're just telling you what their basic values are. So I would say if you ask someone a question about how something works, how a policy works, and the answer comes back, this is my value, then take issue with that, right? Second guess the person and tell them they're not answering your question. We tend not to do that. So that at the individual level, I think we want to talk in terms of consequences, in terms of how things actually work, rather than in terms of values and, you know, simple statements about what we like or dislike. But because we live in a community of knowledge, I think it's a mistake to only think about this issue at the individual level. We also have to think about how these beliefs are supported by those around us. So if we're going to see real change, we have to change the norms of society. We have to make it okay to take issue with someone if they say something that they can't justify. Or we have to make it okay to ask somebody, you know, what the source of their information is.
Okay, I'd like to keep going in that direction a bit. When you talk about this isn't a problem for everybody, it tends to be less of a problem for people who are self-reflective. It makes me think of some of the interviews I've done with some psychologists, both in early childhood education and in adolescent education, that a big part of that kind of self-reflectivity, I think psychologists often talk about it as the executive function of the brain, and that's very profoundly influenced in early childhood, but then also later on. So it seems to me at the social level, we've really got to have some important conversations about how we're raising kids, how we're educating kids, and education is a particular interest of mine since I'm a teacher. So could you talk a little bit more in that direction and some of the implications of this for those kind of higher-level social policy issues and actions?
Sure. So no doubt you're absolutely correct that the educational system, what we teach our kids, is the basis for providing whatever correction we need in the nature of public discourse. There are two points I'd like to make. One is, I do think it's a mistake, though, to think that we can educate ourselves out of this problem. In the way you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that is, people are fundamentally limited in their ability to understand. So if you want to say change minds about climate change, I think it's a mistake to think that you can just teach people how the climate works, teach people about earth sciences, and suddenly we'll all appreciate the danger posed by climate change. Not everybody is capable of learning that stuff or learning it deeply, and moreover, we wouldn't want everybody to spend their time learning earth sciences, right? There are lots of other stuff. There is lots of other stuff that that we want individuals to be learning too. So obviously education has value, but I think it should be focused on directly, you know, what you suggested, namely how to make people more reflective rather than trying to teach people how to think about particular issues. The second thing I'd like to say is that I don't think reflectiveness and executive processing actually are exactly the same thing.
Okay.
So there's a simple measure of how reflective people are that was developed by this psychologist at Yale named Shane Fredericks. So he asked people simple questions. I'll try one out on you. A bat and a ball cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost?
Right. That's in the book, yeah.
It's in the book, so you know the answer.
Yeah.
So I suspect all of your listeners, or the vast majority of your listeners, had the answer 10 cents come to mind. Turns out that's the wrong answer, right? If the bat costs $1 more than the ball, then if the ball costs 10 cents, the bat costs $1.10, and together they cost $1.20. And I said originally they cost $1.10. So the answer isn't hard. A little arithmetic will give it to you. But there is this intuitive answer of 10 cents that sort of magically pops to mind. About 70% of the population just spews out that answer, and you just can't stop them. I mean, it's amazing how frequently you hear that answer and under what conditions people will give you that answer. Even if you tell them the answer is not 10 cents, many people will still say 10 cents. 30% of the population doesn't just throw out the answer, but instead thinks and checks and does the calculation and realizes the answer is not 10 cents and, you know, figures out the right answer, or at least tries to figure out the right answer. So those people are reflective, right? They're reflective because they don't speak before they think. They check their answers before they respond. People who are reflective are not necessarily intelligent. And people who are not reflective sometimes are very intelligent. A significant proportion of students at MIT and Caltech do not pass this test, right? Because they think really fast, and 10 cents comes to mind really fast, and they just throw out that answer. There's a small correlation between performance on this test and measures of intelligence. Correlation's about 0.3, if that means anything to you. So they're not the same, right? I think executive processing is generally thought about by cognitive scientists in a way that's more closely associated with intelligence, right? It's about the horsepower of your brain. Reflectiveness isn't about the horsepower of your brain. It's about your cognitive style. It's about whether you filter or don't filter what your brain produces before you interact with society.
So is there research about how to improve, if that's the right word, that kind of reflectivity? Does it have something to do with, you say that our educational system is incomplete, that it, part of what it doesn't do is teach us how to collaborate with others, or teach us how to recognize what we do know and what we don't know? Is it in there somewhere? And what's the research say about that?
I actually have not encountered much research about how to make people more reflective. There is research showing that if you put people in a kind of logical state of mind, so, you know, if you do things like ask them to solve a bunch of math problems or logic problems, and then give them a test of reflectivity, they will be more reflective than if you ask them to draw a horse or write a poem and then give them a test of reflectivity. So a person's current state of mind will certainly influence how reflective they are. And it's also clear that people are more or less reflective in different domains. So you might have a doctor who's not a very reflective person, but in the office when they're diagnosing their patient's symptoms, suddenly they become very reflective because they've gotten a lot of feedback that they better. Right? I mean, one obvious way to make people more reflective is to show them that they've made a bunch of errors, and so they better be more careful. But that's only going to work within the context in which you've given them that feedback. I don't know of any evidence that you can make people more reflective in general. So what I would hope is that we can, you know, choose the domains in which it matters, domains like political discourse, right? So I convince people that when they're talking about public policy, and particularly when they're arguing with someone who has a different perspective from them, someone who comes from a different ideological community, that that's the time to be reflective. So that kind of context-specific learning, I suspect, is possible, although I don't know of any specific research that has looked at that.
Okay, well, that leads me to another part of your book, which may be a bit controversial for some people, and it's this idea of libertarian paternalism and kind of nudging people in the right directions as maybe a policy-level kind of approach to some of this. Would you just talk about that briefly?
Sure. So there was a book called Nudge, written by a lawyer named Cass Sunstein and a behavioral economist named Dick Thaler. Very popular book, came out a few years ago. And they promote a philosophy they call libertarian paternalism. And the idea of libertarian paternalism is that we could use the insights of behavioral science in order to nudge social policy in directions that people want it to go. So the most famous example of this is, you know, 80% or more than 80% of Americans believe that donating your organs if you die is a good thing, and they want to be. They just think in general that that's something people should do. They should donate their organs when they die. And yet, only, you know, some much, much smaller proportion of people actually do donate their organs. And it turns out one reason for that is that in order to be an organ donor in many states, you have to sign the back of your driver's license to say you want to be an organ donor. In states in which you have to sign the back of your driver's license in order not to be an organ donor, they have much, much higher organ donation rates than in states where you sign the back of your license in order to be an organ donor. In other words, merely the act of having to sign the back of your driver's license has a huge influence. It prevents people from being organ donors. So, armed with this insight, you know, we could change social policy such that you have to sign the back of your driver's license in order not to be an organ donor, and then we'd have something like an 80% organ donation rate, and policy would be much more compatible with people's values, with what they want. So the idea of libertarian paternalism is that here's a policy that's paternalistic in the sense that society is constructing a method of making a decision, namely signing the back of your driver's license, in order to achieve an end. Right? They're constructing this method of choice. Sunstein and Thaler call it an architecture of choice. They're designing the architecture of choice in order to cause people to be more likely to be organ donors. And so that's paternalistic in a way, but it's libertarian in the sense that you're not taking any choices away from people, right? Everybody still has the freedom to be an organ donor or not to be an organ donor. So their general philosophy is that we can use behavioral science to inform society to help people to live in the way that they actually want to live. And this is perfectly consistent with what we're proposing in the book, that we live in a community of knowledge, right? The idea is that when we think, and in particular when we make decisions, we make those decisions within a community. We're supported by other people's thoughts. Many of our judgments and choices are made by virtue of what other people are thinking. And so why not make that explicit and design the process by which we make decisions in order to take into account the fact that people tend not to know very much. You know, if when people are making financial decisions about, say, where to invest their money, these are incredibly complex decisions, and you know, very, very few people have all that much expertise. Why not use society to help people make the decisions that will benefit the investor, him or herself? That's sort of the basic idea of libertarian paternalism.
Yeah, that's great. So I just want to announce, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is cognitive scientist Steve Sloman, co-author of The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines. I've actually got a caller coming in right now. If you'd like to join the conversation and ask Steve any questions, please give us a call at 707-895-2448. Yes, hi there. You're going to have to turn off your radio, and then if you'd give me your first name, please.
It's Greg.
Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
I'm sure...
Steve Sloman, yeah.
I have a suspicion you don't totally agree with the father knows best approach, which is what you just suggested. I understand the idea of community, but I think that having people make decisions like that and create passive situations for people to become part of something that they think is important to them is wrong. And I think that a better approach would be to put on in more documents or inform people more to say, if you want to donate your organs, make sure you sign or don't sign, whatever. I think sign. But I think it's important to inform people, and I think there's something really wrong with our education system, which I personally was very much a part of all the way up into university, and I didn't feel like I really got the gist of thinking as a community until I got to graduate school. And I think that's wrong, too. I think that we should be, you kind of touched on this earlier about collaborative thinking. And I think that's a really strong thing. But I think that what you're talking about is not collaborative. It's paternalistic, and it has a judgmental component or autocratic decision process that I find unfavorable. I'm just curious what your opinion is on that.
So I was not able to hear all of that question. So I was able to hear part of it. Can I try to answer what I heard and you'll tell me what I missed?
Sure.
So I think the listener agrees that collaborative thinking is what we do, is something that is natural for human beings and something that should be supported, but the listener is not comfortable with the notion of libertarian paternalism, essentially because he thinks it's too paternalistic and society should not be paternalistic. Is that the gist of the question?
Yeah, and I'm curious. I mean, because it seems to me that, and I'm sorry, I'm not framing this as a question, but I'll try to. It seems to me that our educational system isn't designed to make us independent thinkers, to make us put ideas together, to make us wonder where the information comes from, which is one of the things that was taught to me in graduate school. It's like, oh, who wrote this? Oh, his teacher was blah, blah. It really gave you a sense of where the information is coming from. I don't think we get that in the lower grades, and I think it does disjustice to people when you don't know how to see if the information you're getting is accurate and then make a decision putting things together. But I like the idea of the collaborative community thing because that allows us to talk, which I think is extremely important.
Okay. Well, I mean, it sounds on the issue of education, we entirely agree. And I absolutely think that it's it's very important that kids are taught about the importance of not only what they know, but what they don't know from a very early age, so that they become masters at not only understanding the limits of their own knowledge, but being able to fill in the gaps when necessary, and appreciating that any successful thought process is going to be one that's collaborative. So I couldn't agree more. I'm not an expert on elementary education, and so I'm not going to make any comments about the way things are in fact done today. I do know that there's some evidence that teaching young kids in a collaborative way, a woman named Anne Brown developed something called the jigsaw method of teaching, which turns individual kids into experts in their own areas and then puts them together to work on group projects. I think, you know, that kind of method might be a terrific way to address what you're suggesting, which we agree on. Back to this, I think, very different issue about the value of libertarian paternalism and how we should make decisions about things like organ donation. I just want to make one observation, which is that whenever society allows individuals to make decisions about anything, there has to be a procedure to do that, right? So you have to either sign the back of your license plate to be an organ donor or not to be an organ donor, or send in a letter, or, you know, tick a box online or make a phone call. There has to be something you do in order to make a decision, right? There are voting procedures for elections. So the only suggestion being offered by these people is that when we construct these methods of decision making, we do so consciously and we do so carefully. And we do so knowing that the method of decision making itself is going to have an effect on the final outcome. And so if we're going to influence the outcome one way or another, so let's do it in a way that's consistent with what it is that people want. That's the argument.
I'm going to take another call here. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
My name's Robert.
Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a curious experience listening to the show, because early on, your guest challenged us to draw a picture of a bicycle and identify how the relationship between the chain and the sprocket and everything like that. And I got a little huffy about it personally. I'm a person who I'm more concerned generally with how things are made and how they are designed, which is a somewhat different question. I ran for a piece of paper and a pencil, and I had no trouble drawing a reasonable mechanical diagram. But I realized, on reflecting afterwards, that it had been kind of a process. You know, I had a couple of different, I had a mental image of what a bare frame of a bicycle looks like, and I had a mental image of replacing the chain on the sprockets, you know, with the pedals nearby. And I got to thinking about how things are designed and how that relates to how they work. And it seems to me that things are designed more by a process of successive refinement. People try things and they work or they don't work, or they can improve them and so forth. It's not there's not a genius having a platonic conception of an idealized bicycle and then somehow bringing that magically into fruition. And so I wound up thinking that the relationship of society to the machines that we make is a matter not only of collective knowledge, but also collective ignorance. Because I don't think we really do. I think you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who really can truly say they understand how something works. I recall within my own lifetime, which is to say long after the basic design of the bicycle was completed, that physicists have been studying how bicycles work in terms of the stability of riding a bicycle and stuff. So I think there's things we still don't know about how a bicycle works, and that's a fairly simple machine. I wondered if your guest could comment any on my reflection.
Thanks, Robert.
I'll take it off the air.
Thanks.
Well, thanks, Robert, for those observations. They seem right on target, and you know, you've certainly gone beyond what I was suggesting. I think that the idea that design is a process of successive refinement makes a lot of sense. And if you consider that that refinement is often something that takes place not only within an individual, but across individuals, right? So one person designs things one way, and then another person sees the outcome and changes it, and a third person changes that. I actually think that's the way most artifacts get designed over time. We can see the influence of the collectivity in precisely the way that you're suggesting, through a process of successive refinement. It's an interesting question what the difference is between design and understanding mechanism. It seems that understanding mechanism is a prerequisite for design. I guess you could design new mechanisms, but even then you have to sort of understand how they work at some level. And I couldn't agree more that, you know, complexity is everywhere. So everything we look at can be looked at in many, many different ways, and many of those things are not understood. It's actually, you know, I play a lot of squash, right? I don't know if your Northern California listeners are even familiar with the game, but it's a racket sport involving a little ball in a small cell, and I play with a physicist, and he tells me that physicists really don't understand why it is that the balls cling to the wall of the squash court as much as they do. So there's all this stuff that we don't understand. Absolutely, the world is complex, and that's all the more reason to appreciate how much we depend on each other, because we, as individuals, bring such a small amount to bear. Now, I'm not sure if I fully understand what the listener was suggesting, but I will say that in my experience, a lot of people do think they understand things. They may not think they understand them perfectly, but a lot of people think they understand things much better than they do. And in fact, When I talk at business schools, I invariably have someone come up to me and tell me how this is the major problem in management teams, that you have some overconfident individual who thinks they know everything, usually a man, right? And he shuts everyone else up and makes everyone else feel inferior and makes it impossible for the team to work effectively. So I actually think there's a lot of overconfidence about how things work, and sounds like Robert doesn't have that overconfidence, and I wish more people were like him.
Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call here. Hi there, you're on the air. If you turn off your radio, please,
it's
and
off.
Give me your first name, and you have to ask your question pretty quickly. We're down
okay,
to the end.
Okay, I'm Kathy, and I hope this isn't too long of a question, so if it is, I will just pass on it. But I was wondering if there's any comparison between Abraham Maslow's The Self-Actualized Person and the process he's describing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I don't know enough about Maslow's theorizing to really say. It's not something I have studied in depth. I'm sure that being well-calibrated, that is, having a good sense of what you understand and what you don't, contributes to well-being, and self-actualization sounds like something that means you have a good, strong sense of well-being. But I would like to point out that in the last chapter of my book, we sort of address this question about whether illusions are a bad thing. You know, Voltaire said that illusions are the first of all pleasures. And it does not seem to me that we necessarily want to live in a world devoid of illusion. Right? As I said earlier, people who live with the knowledge illusion are often more interesting because they're more willing to engage, and they're more willing to take chances. So it's not obvious to me that you would want to evaluate someone on the basis of whether or not they suffer from the knowledge illusion. Sometimes it goes way too far and causes a lot of damage. But when you're talking about someone who's not at that point, I would withhold judgment.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Steve. We're at the end of the hour. You've been listening to Consider This on KZYX. My guest has been cognitive scientist Steve Sloman, S-L-O-M-A-N. The book is The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Steve, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Stuart. This is great.
Okay, bye-bye.